All right, Exodus chapter 2, this is the second book of the Bible. We're going to be continuing on. Today we get to meet Moses. Moses is one of the most famous people in all the Bible, probably at least top four, maybe top six, maybe top eight, depends upon your definitions. If you remember last week, we kind of got started looking back at the history of where the Israelite people were. The whole entire Old Testament is about God choosing a people for himself called the people of Israel, okay? We know them today as the Jewish people. It's the same group. You're also going to hear them called the Hebrews. It's the same thing, okay? I was trying to think of a good analogy for this. It's like cat, kitten, house tiger. Like, it's like Hebrew, Jewish, Israel. It's all the same thing. It's God's people in the Old Testament. Okay, and we found that they're in slavery in Egypt. They've been there for about 400 years. The Pharaoh of Egypt got a little bit creeped out at how many people they had. And he started to worry that they might start to overthrow the Egyptian government. And so he starts to oppress them. He makes them his slaves, and he starts to kind of turn up the heat on them. Even worse than that, we saw this last week, is he's going to start to kill all the male children that are born to the Israelites. So as we pick up chapter 2 here, that's the setting for Moses being born. He's one of the Hebrew children going to be born at the threat of being killed by the evil Pharaoh of Egypt. So we'll start in chapter 2, verse 1, and we'll read, "Now a man from the house of Levi went and took his wife, a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. When she could no longer hide him, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and dabbed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, 'This is one of the Hebrews' children.' Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter," it's Moses' sister, "'Shall I go and call a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?' And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Go.' So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you wages.' So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she became her son, and he became her son. She named him Moses because, she said, 'I drew him out of the water.'" Okay, so this is Moses. This is how he gets introduced into the story of the Bible. Okay, when he's born, his mother hides him in their home for 3 months. Okay, remember, he's supposed to be murdered. That's the edict in Egypt. Apparently, she can only hide him for so long. I think little children become whiny babies, become crawling toddlers, and then it's harder to hide a crying, crawling toddler. That's my non-parenting take on the situation. She can't hide him anymore, and so she has a plan. She puts him in a basket, and she walks down to the river and sets him in the river. Okay, that's what she did. And it says Moses' sister kind of stayed nearby to watch to see what was going to happen. Well, the daughter of the Pharaoh comes along, and she has some servant girls, but apparently she's going to take a bath, comes down to the river, middle of the day, and they notice that there's a basket floating in the water. Okay, she sends one of her servant girls over, she opens the basket, and there's Moses, and says he's crying. The Pharaoh's daughter recognizes right away that it must be one of the Hebrew children. She probably realizes their parents must have set the child in the river, hoping to save it in some regard. And verse 6 says, when she sees him, when she knows this, she takes pity on the child. Okay. Now, I don't know if this was Moses' mother's plan all along, set the baby near where Pharaoh's daughter is going to be, I don't know that you could say 100% certainty that that was her plan all along. But we do see in this that this is God's first rescue in this story. Moses is completely helpless. This is a chance for him to be removed from all of history. We never find out anything beyond this of Moses. And God sends a sympathetic Egyptian woman who happens to be the daughter of the Pharaoh to be the first to find him. Okay? Instead of being killed, he gets cared for. Let's talk about Moses' sister for a second. I don't know where she fits into this. I don't know how old she was. She either knew the Pharaoh's daughter, or she was just a brave young extrovert willing to go and talk to the Pharaoh and her servants. Either way, she gets herself involved here. Okay, she goes over and says, "Shall I go get a nurse for the child?" She sees that they have identified a baby, and she says, "I know what we could do." Well, the Pharaoh's daughter agrees to this. Says, "Yeah, go get a nurse. In fact, go get a Hebrew nurse." What does Moses' sister do? It's like, I know a woman who could nurse the child. She goes and gets her own mother, Moses' mother, brings her back and gives Moses back to his own mother to be nursed by his own mother. Even more than that, Pharaoh's daughter says, "Here, take some money. I'll pay you to nurse the child." She has no idea. She doesn't know that this is Moses' mother nursing her own child. Eventually, Moses grows up. I guess he's beyond the age of being weaned. And Moses' mother gives him back to Pharaoh's daughter. They must have made some agreement that the child would become hers later on. And so Moses, his mother, gives the child to the Pharaoh's daughter eventually. Now, certainly this couldn't have been Moses' mother's plan. Not the part about getting paid to nurse her own. Talk about state funding for sort of an early welfare system, maybe. There's no way she could have arranged these details, could she? There's no way she could have made up this stuff. If she made up this plan, she's a crazy woman, okay? There's no way she made this up. But the way things turn out, she gets more time with her son. Her son gets put into a safer surrounding than he could have possibly had. It's not just he's in a house that can protect him. He's within Pharaoh's house, and Pharaoh's not going to kill his own adopted grandson, is he? He'd hope not. And she also gets paid. Okay, this turned out way better than she could have ever planned or imagined. Now, there's two things I think we should pay attention to here. Number one, God protects his people. God protects his people. As we've said, Moses should have been killed. He's discovered by an Egyptian. The Pharaoh's daughter, according to the law at the time, should have killed him. He should have died. But God saw to it that the person that discovered him was a soft-hearted gal that was unwilling to murder a baby. This is God's doing. On the surface, this doesn't seem all that miraculous, does it? It's ironic for sure. Okay, it's heartwarming. It's almost satisfying in the turn of events that it's Pharaoh's own daughter that prevents Moses' death. But it's not as if God comes in loud and thunderous with power and force and makes something happen. It's not like he, you know, ties somebody's hands or kills somebody or knocks somebody over. It's a much simpler and much more organic solution, isn't it? Here's the two parts I would throw at you. God created Pharaoh's daughter with a personality that had a tender heart for children, or somewhere along the line, as she got older and became old enough to bear children of her own, she would be soft-hearted, tender-hearted towards children. And then part two, he made her realize she should probably go take a bath in the river that day. That's the two things that lined up for Moses to be rescued. I think this is often how God works. Not always miraculous, not always super, you know, planned out, but just sort of through the slow processes of human desire and choice. People make their own choices. The details of life line up in a certain way. And God is holding all these things together, like a puppet master. You guys know puppet master? It's the guy with the fingers, the string on his fingers, and the puppet hangs down below and it dances for him. God controls all things. But not just that, he gives everybody the free will to choose what they want, so he's not controlling them as if they're, you know, pawns on a chessboard. But he is keeping all things in balance. He's keeping all things under his control. And oftentimes, it's just the slow process of what God allows and helps along and turns and touches and moves to where the situation ends up being God's movement in history. Let me give you an example. Okay, this is a little bit apart from our subject tonight, but let's say that there's an oncoming car rushing at you and it just barely missed you. You're on the highway, it's going 55, you're going 55. The last minute it swerved and missed you, okay? Does that mean God turned the steering wheel of the other person's car at the last second? Maybe, it could totally happen. Does that mean God alerted the driver, woke them up, you know, so that they could make the right correction to their car? That's possible. Another possibility is that driver, two or three blocks, or, well, we're on a highway now, so my analogy's not going to work. Two or three stoplights ago, they got stuck at a stoplight. It delayed them just long enough to when they're on the highway, they're not far enough, so far along, where they actually made contact with you. It helped their car stay backward in its time and space long enough to avoid hitting you. It doesn't mean God wasn't doing the things, but it wasn't this miraculous last-minute saving of you. It's a little bit more of the natural processes of life. Sometimes that's how God works. And the thing is, we need to know this. It's not only in the miraculous things that God is rescuing, protecting, and saving us. It's at all times. Any time that we're not harmed, any time that we're not hurt, we can credit God for having kept an eye out for us so that we didn't come to harm or destruction. Okay? It's always God. He's not this distant, removed God that's far away, that doesn't care about what's going on in our world. He's actively watching, doing, and acting on our behalf. God protects his people, and the Bible would support that. Sasha and I just started reading the Psalms last week, maybe. Every psalm follows the kind of this pattern of the psalmist saying, like, God, where are you? And then they go on to detail all the trouble they're in, and then it gets to the very end, they're like, oh yeah, and thank you, God, for helping me. It's kind of like the schizophrenic moment of the psalmist is like fearful and nervous, and then when they remind themselves of how good God is and that he protects them, then they're like, oh yeah, and by the way, thank you. I never doubted it for a second, you know. God protects his people. What this should do for us is it should give us confidence. We don't got to worry. We don't got to worry about accidents. Sure, accidents happen. There's no guarantee we're not going to be hurt. We're not going to have a health scare. There's no guarantee that those things won't happen. But this should give us confidence that God protects us. God actively watches out for us. Nothing is going to happen to us unless he allows it. Okay, nothing is going to happen to us unless he allows it to happen. Nobody's going to die early. You're going to die right on time, right when God said it's time. Okay? Now, we live in a fallen world. We talked about this at street level on Monday. So there's bad things that happen. There is tragedy. There is accidents. And yet God's the one that's in control of it all. We can't pretend like we know all the answers to why these things happen. But certainly God protects his people. And that's something we should have confidence in. Okay, so we don't need to live in fear. We can live with confidence. Secondly, in what we've read so far, I think we need to just point out God's plans are better than our own. And we're gonna look at Moses' mother for a minute here. We've already kind of given the details, but we'll recap this here. She makes this plan to save her son. Okay, I'm going to put him in a basket in the river. Basically, the kid is now totally out of her control. She has no say in the matter any longer. Okay, she puts him in a basket, hopes that the right person finds him, hopes that he lives, hopes that he's safe. Now, her plan may or may not have purposefully put him near the Pharaoh's daughter. You know, it's possible she knew them. It's possible her daughter knew them. She may have been working the system a little bit here. That's possible. But no matter how you look at it, God's plan turned out better than her own. God took what she did, and he stepped into the situation, and he worked these things even far beyond what she could have imagined, more than she could ask or think. Okay. In order for this to happen, though, she had to let go of the control of her plan and let God take over. And this is important for us. It is very important for all of us in this room. In order for this to happen, for Moses' mother and for us, we do have to let go of the control of the outcome of the plans that we make. So what does this mean? How would we describe this? Well, you can think about it this way. She could have continued trying to keep Moses hidden. And again, that crying baby toddler that's just ruthlessly crawling everywhere. That would have been a difficult task for her. She could have tried to keep him safe until he's old enough to protect himself. That's a long, long road. But instead, she trusts God. She says, God can do this better than I can. And again, whether you agree with her decision or not, in this circumstance, she had to make a choice. Okay, she was going to have to let him go one way or the other. But she gives God control of the outcome. That's what she does. We need to follow the same pattern in our lives. I don't think we'll ever be faced with this exact circumstance that we're describing here. But all of us are going to make plans in our lives. We're all going to make plans about our futures. We're all going to make plans about our relationships. We're all going to make plans of who we want to be, what we want our life to be, where we want to go, who we want to be with. When we do that, we need to make sure that we're seeking God for the direction. And once things get into motion, we need to be okay with God redirecting us as he sees fit. Once things get started in motion, that doesn't mean we're locked into that exact identical plan, like we nailed it perfectly and now we're just going to linearly walk forward. That's usually not how it goes. We need to allow God to redirect our steps. Sometimes we just got the plan wrong in the beginning. Best of our intention, we wanted to do it right. Sometimes it just wasn't the right thing, and now we realize that now we need to make a turn. That's possible. It happens all the time. It happens to me, happens to her, happens to you. It happens to everybody in this room. I don't know who I pointed at. It was actually kind of like up. So sometimes we got it right, but just not 100% right. Right direction, wrong timing, something like that. And we need to let God modify our timing. But we do need to let God redirect us as we go. One of the biggest mistakes I see young people, especially college students, making, you have a plan, but you totally lock yourselves into it, and you just end up stuck. You're excited about something. You dreamed about it for a while. You hoped for it, and now it's here. And I totally get it. I still get that way. I'm a 40-year-old man. I get excited about my own plans. Ask my wife. But where I think people go wrong is they lock themselves into it so much that they don't leave any room for the Lord to step in and give his guidance, his redirection, his course correction, and all the rest. So you come to college and you're like, this is how I'm going to spend my time. I'm going to stay disciplined. I'm going to stay focused. I'm going to give this much time to this. I'm going to give this much time to this, this much time to this. Okay, you have a plan. That's great. I prefer that to the no plan plan. That was always my plan. Okay. The no plan plan is not a plan, if that's you. Okay, it's no plan. Self-fulfilling prophecy. You might have this idea of where you're going to go for your career. Good. Read the room. Study hard. Get the grades that you can get. Make contacts with the places that you'd like to work for. Feel out the process. You got to move in some direction, don't you? So do it. Ask God for his help and make sure that it fits with what he's telling you to do. This could go the same way for the relationships we'll have, the dating relationships, even the friendships, the roommate relationships, and all the rest. What I see a lot of college students do, and I'm sorry, but that's what I'm looking at right now for the most part. Either in your enthusiasm and excitement, or sometimes in your just sheer stubbornness, you lock yourself into your plan. You double down on it, and you try and force it to happen, even when it's not going well. And you probably know it, but you think you can overcome and just make it work. This is where a lot of people go wrong, okay? Some don't. Some course correct. Some seek God's help, and they move onto the path that they get a sense that he's now leading them into. But many won't, and many don't. Okay? I would love for all of you to experience what it's like to be fully locked in on the plan the Lord has for you. This is a living relationship, by the way. You might think you know what it is at 30, but I promise you by 40, it's quite a bit different than what you thought. You know less than you thought you did. You might have more peace and surety that you're where you're supposed to be, but I promise you have less sort of general confidence that it was you that made the right choices to get there. You know, when you're 30, you're going to have the same feeling about your 20-year-old self. I should have done different increments, but when you're 25, you'll have different feelings about your 22-year-old self. Time helps, but as God who reveals the plan, it's this unfolding mystery in each of our lives, we get a sense of who God is and what he wants us to do. And as we seek that out, we gain sure footing under our feet. Okay, and the choice is whether or not we're going to do it with God or just do it on our own. Okay, I'd love for everybody to experience this. I feel like I'm there, but it's totally imperfect. It's not storybook. Don't make a movie out of this, you know. This is a made-for-TV after-school special. It's a cautionary tale, really. Or it's reality TV. Maybe that'd be a better way. But not made up. It's real, okay? But here's the thing. God's plans are better, and that's what I want you to experience. God has a plan for you. God has a plan for what he wants you to do in your life. There's some work to be done. There's ministry to happen. Okay. In order to get there, you're going to have to lay down your own pride, your own agenda, your own expectations, and say, Lord, I'll do what you want me to do. You're going to have to make that choice. You're going to have to make that statement. And I'm not saying he won't take what you're already doing and use that. He very well could. But without humility, without giving the Lord the opportunity to do that, he's not going to use you in that way until you're willing to let him. Okay. Moses' mother puts her son in a basket. She puts him in the river, and God takes over. Let's keep reading here. This is going to be fast-forwarding 40 years in Moses' life. Verse 11, one day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people, and he looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? He answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid, and he thought, surely this thing is known. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. So real quick here, Moses kills a guy. He grew up in Egypt. He was raised in the Pharaoh's household, best education. He learned their culture and all the rest. And yet he still understood that he was an Israelite. He still identified himself as an Israelite. So when he sees an Egyptian harming, maybe even about to kill an Israelite, he steps in, and instead of helping the Egyptian kill the Israelite, he helps the Israelite stay alive because that's his brother or his sister or whoever it was. He identified still as an Israelite despite how he grew up. The next day, he goes back out. He sees two Israelite men fighting, and he's like, what the heck? You can't even get along with each other. One of them was in the wrong, and so he asked that guy, what's going on? Why are you hitting the other guy? And they sort of make it known that they saw what he did yesterday. They watched him kill the Egyptian man and bury him in the sand, and this makes him worried. So Moses is scared. He's now a man without a country, really. He's no longer Egyptian because he's took his stand. The Hebrews, the Israelites, they're now against him. And so it says he flees. He leaves Egypt. He goes to a place called Midian, which is basically just in the middle of nowhere. Okay, it's mountains in a desert, east of Egypt, south of Israel. And so he runs away. Okay, real quick, why did he kill the Egyptian? You could say he's a good man, he has a sense of justice, he's a man of action. He wants to protect somebody that's helpless and needs help. You could say that. You could say it's because he identified as an Israelite. In this fight between the Israelites and the Egyptians, he was taking his side. He was making it clear that he wasn't an Egyptian. And so he fights back against the evil of Egypt. I would think that reason is probably more supported biblically. If you read into the New Testament, there's a couple of places where the story of Moses gets mentioned. Hebrews chapter 11 is one of them. Listen to what it says. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he grew up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. There's places in the Bible where the New Testament gives commentary about what happened in the Old Testament. We need to listen to those places. We can have our conjecture and come up with our theories about what the Old Testament meant, but how about if God said it in the New Testament just to clarify for us what it meant? We need to pay attention to these. It's saying here, Moses took a stand. He wasn't going to live for Egypt. He was going to live for God and God's people. And so he identifies the Hebrews as his people. He identifies God as his God. That's why he kills the Egyptian. He's saying, this is who I am. This is what I'm about. This is the side that I'm on. He chose his side. In a sense, he was both Egyptian and Jewish. Okay, he had two heritages, two cultures. Okay, as Christians, we have a parallel. If we're a Christian, we're both an American and a Christian. We have two countries. We have America and we have heaven. We're citizens of both here and there. In a sense, we're children of our parents, but we're also children of God. Double heritage there, double inheritance. We're both students at UW-Stout or CBTC and students of Jesus. Again, there's a double, I don't know, whammy, we'll call it. But in this way, we're sort of in a similar situation to Moses. And what I want to tell you is we actually have to pick which one of those rises to the top above the other. If you're a Christian, you're a Christian first, you're an American second, or an Indian second, or a Nepalese second. If you're a blue devil, you're a Christian first and a blue devil second. It's terrible that it's a blue devil, because it just doesn't, there's no comparison, you know? If you're a son or daughter of your blood family, you're a son or daughter of God first, and a son or daughter of them second. Just like Moses, you have to pick your priority. Okay? This is a controversial subject in our day and age. In America, there's this big idea that nothing is more important than family. I mean, that's kind of preached as the common, universal ideal in America. But is it true? Not if you want to listen to Jesus. Not if you want to follow Jesus. Jesus comes to earth and he brings peace. Peace with God. Okay? He also brings division. And he says that division will include even between you and the family members in your own household. Brother and sister, mother and daughter, stepmother and stepdaughter. Jesus says, if people are going to follow me, then families are going to be divided naturally. Because some are going to follow me and some aren't. And that's going to be a very, very dividing factor. If you can't read the Bible and come to the conclusion that Jesus says, love your family first, family is most important, that's not true, not biblically. You can believe that if you want, but it's not supported by Christianity. Christianity says God comes first. Jesus even said, it's going to possibly look like you hate your family by comparison to the love you have for me. Didn't he say that? He did. Moses here takes his stance, his Egyptian family, his Israelite family. And he makes his choice. we have to make that same choice. I'm not saying you leave your family behind. I'm not saying you shun them. But I'm saying you put God as a higher priority than even your own family. Anything else in your life, really. The church in America, Christianity in America, is going to try and blend those two things together, and that's where they go wrong. Generally speaking, not picking on anybody in particular, but trying to marry those two things doesn't work. Now you have two gods, the God of family and God himself. Okay. Moses makes his choice, he takes his stand, and he chooses his side. Okay. It's a difficult truth, but it's real. So let me ask you, do you identify as Christian more than anything else? More than as a stout blue devil? Okay. More than as a Menominee citizen? I don't know. More than as American? More than as somebody's son or somebody's daughter? Do you identify as a Christian more than all those things? Next, real quick. I said that before, but I lied. Why did Moses kill or get involved? He didn't kill, but why did he get involved with the two Israelite people fighting? Really, it's probably the same reason. He wants God's people to flourish. That's why he stepped in and helped the Israelite being beaten by the Egyptian. Here he sees two Israelites fighting. He's trying to either make peace or try and at least help the one who's being wronged. So it's really probably the same reason. It would have been a lot easier if he hadn't got involved, wouldn't it? He doesn't know them, apparently. He has nothing that he owes them, seemingly. But he gets himself involved. Okay. And I think this is just the kind of guy that Moses was. Now, you might ask, does God use people that have good intentions? Well, yes, if they act upon those intentions. Does God use people that only have good intentions, no actions? I would say no. They're not doing anything. They're not acting upon their intentions. Therefore, they're not really being used, or at least they're not useful to God. The Bible says it this way. You say that some people have faith and some people have works. Okay, some people have belief and some people have action. But I'll say, I'll show you my faith by my works. I'll show you my belief by what I do. God uses people that step to action. And that's the kind of person Moses is. He's going to get himself involved in an inconvenient situation between people that, I don't know, maybe he knew, maybe he didn't, because it's the right thing to do. Because it's important to him that God's people don't look foolish and they're arguing with each other in a way that's making God look bad. There's something in this for us. We have to choose what kind of person we're going to be. We have to choose whether we'll do the right thing, even if it's inconvenient. We have to choose whether we'll risk the loss of reputation by picking a side. By the way, you're always going to lose some reputation when you pick a side. The opposite side is going to think less of you, guaranteed. That's always going to happen. Will we stand up for people when they're being wronged? I'm not just talking like Walker, Texas Ranger style justice where you're like, you know, roundhouse kicking people and growing beards and stuff. We're talking about somebody that will step in, not always just in a fight, physical, but how about a drama? How about a situation where two people can't come to an agreement? They need help, even if it's inconvenient for you. I'm not saying meddle in other people's affairs. But I'm saying, are you willing to be a peacemaker? Are you willing to be somebody that involves themselves? In this case, it's two of God's people. So think in the church that you go to. Are you willing to know and be known by people? Are you willing to involve yourself in their life? Maybe they think you're a good Christian because you show up for church on Sunday. But one of those two people isn't going to like you as much if you get involved in their business, if you take a side, I guess. Moses is for God. He's for God's people, he's for justice, he's for truth. Are you for those things? Are you for those things? Okay, this whole situation puts Moses into this really strange situation. He's made his decision, He's chosen his side. I don't think he knows yet God's going to use him. But now he's on the run. Now nobody likes him, except maybe the one Israelite. All right, let's continue on. Finishing up verse 15, he sat down by a well. See, I was quick on that last one. Verse 16, now the priests of Midian had seven daughters. So he goes to Midian. This is the desert. This is the mountains. This is outside of Egypt. The priests of Midian had seven daughters. They came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flocks. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them, and he watered their flock. When they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, how is it that you have come home so soon today? They said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and he even drew water for us and watered the flock. When he said to his daughters, then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him, that he may eat bread. Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. Call her Zippy. My sister had a college roommate. I think her name was Zipporah, and they called her Zippy. Okay, so I think future modern translations of the Bible are going to work that way. Verse 22, she gave birth to a son. She called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. All right, so Moses leaves Egypt. He goes to a place called Midian. He just can't stop being a hero anywhere that he goes. Okay, these women he doesn't know, they come out to water their flocks. Some just bandits come along, shepherd bandits, and they start messing with these ladies, and he stands up for them. Okay, he chases the guys away, and then he, ever the gentleman that he is, he helps them draw water from the well and water their flocks. Okay, this is the kind of guy Moses was. Okay? And it's no wonder why God chooses him to lead the nation later. He's a man of action, he's a man of integrity, he's a man of justice. It's no wonder. He was living this life all along. Okay, so the women go back and tell their father. The father's like, why didn't you bring the man back? We could at least give him a snack. The gals go get him. Apparently they offer for Moses to live there with them. Doesn't really say how much time has passed. Moses and Zippy, they seem to have a thing for each other. And then they get married and then they start having kids. Now, Moses is going to spend the next 40 years of his life here. He left Egypt after 40 years. So that was life number one for him. Basically, he was full-on Egyptian. Now for the next 40 years, he's just going to be nobody, living in the desert, being a shepherd, being a father, being a married dude. He's just going to be in Midian. And most people would tell you, most commentaries, most theologians, they're going to tell you that God uses these next 40 years to prepare Moses for the ministry that he's going to receive to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. The Israelites are going to stay there. They're still going to be oppressed by the Egyptians. Things are going to get bad. They're going to cry out to God. That's what the end of our chapter tonight is going to say. And all along, during those next 40 years, God's preparing Moses to be the leader to lead them out. And there's a couple ways that kind of seem obvious if you give it a little bit of thought. Moses is going to be leading sheep around in the desert. Okay, so he's leading stubborn sheep in the desert, preparing to lead stubborn people around in the desert. Okay? It's no wonder that the Bible often uses sheep or flock to describe a group of Christians, or God's people. The second thing is, this place where he is, Midian, this is actually the same land that the Israelites are going to escape to. They're going to leave Egypt, they're going to cross the Red Sea. Remember, that's where God parts the sea and they walk across on dry land. Guess where they go to? Midian. He's going to get familiar with this land, apparently. God's going to give him 40 years to memorize every turn, you know, every rock. This allows enough time for his crime back in Egypt. Remember, he murdered a guy. This is going to allow enough time to pass for that to be forgotten. Pharaoh's going to die. Anybody that remembers is going to either die or lose their memory of it. Okay, this allows enough time to pass where he's no longer, you know, wanted in Egypt. This is also going to age Moses into an elderly man. He's not going to be like a strong, vigorous 40, as is true about all living men. he's now going to be an older 80-year-old man, elderly, not as physically strong, okay, not as able to just take matters into his own hands. And maybe he still could, I don't know. But less likely anyway. He's going to have to rely on God's strength. He's going to have to rely on God's actions. But this idea of God setting somebody into a testing, training period of time of their life, this is common to how God trains leaders for ministry. He sets people into a season of time for them to be prepared. Okay, a time of humble service, basic obedience, godly patience. There's many examples of this in the Bible. Abraham wanders the promised land without a home for a while, with no son, with no prospect of a son. And God seems to be preparing him for what's to come. Joseph, he gets arrested in Egypt. He gets put in prison for years and years. That seemed to be a time of preparation for him to actually help Egypt out of a famine later. Daniel gets put in prison in Babylon. The Apostle Paul, he becomes a Christian. You know what he does? First thing he does? I think he goes down to Arabia and spends either 3 or 14 years, I can't remember which number right now, preparing to be the Apostle Paul, leading the church, leading the missionary efforts of the church. Jesus himself went into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. Remember that? God seems to have this pattern where he puts people into situations to be prepared for their ministry. And I'm not saying it's always exactly that way, but if you look through the Bible, if you look at Christian history, you'll see that this is often the case. Listen to what this says. This is a quote. It is a tendency among human beings to seek immediate power and influence. Even Christians have a tendency to force their way into positions of leadership. They look for a Bible study to lead, a ministry to oversee, an audience who will admire their wisdom or elegance or intellect or ability. But God doesn't work this immediately. Instead, God often allows or even requires time to pass in a person's life in order for them to grow in character, and to test their faithfulness in what Jesus called the little things. It is impossible to know how long the preparation will last, but for those who God will use, the perceived delay in their ministry to the Lord is not a deterrent to their faithfulness, it is merely an opportunity to exercise it. A lot of people get turned off by this. They want some immediate action or immediate results or immediate recognition. Okay, there's this diverging path that people kind of go in. One, when they realize they're going to have to wait a long time to get involved in a ministry, they'll just force their way into something. Just give me something, give me anything, instead of waiting on God. The other path, they give up entirely. It's not worth the wait. Okay, either path, you end up in a bad situation. I don't know which one's worse. But this is often what people do. Moses is going to live the most normal life for the next 40 years. He's a dad. He's a shepherd. He's going to worship God. He's going to wander around in the wilderness. Really impressive, right? Seems like good training for ministry. If he's faithful in what he does, it's perfect training for ministry. You know why? Because that's exactly where God put him. If anybody in here has a heart for future ministry, a desire to be used by God, you have to entertain the idea that where God has you now might be preparation for the future of what he'll do with you later. This is often what God does. Now, God does have a plan for Moses. We're not going to get there tonight. It's going to be 40 years in the wilderness here, but he's going to start into motion this plan to lead the people out of Egypt. Let's finish the chapter here and we'll wrap things up. During those many days, the king of Egypt died. That's verse 23. The people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Okay, so the people continue to be oppressed. And they cry out to God, and he hears them. That's their only responsibility in this. Ask God for help, and they do it faithfully. God's not going to do it just yet. He's going to wait 40 years, presumably for Moses. Not saying I know the exact reason why, but they go through this for 40 more years. And we'll talk about this more next week, them crying out to God. But here's what we know for now. God did not abandon his people. God was not ignoring his people. God was not powerless or helpless to act with his people. We also know that God is patient, that God has concern about his people's welfare, that God has a plan for when and how he's going to act, when he's going to do the things that he does. It's easy to get impatient when we don't think God is acting fast enough. For these Israelites, certainly it would have been easy for them to become impatient. Okay? But they do their part. They call out to God, and he's going to start to respond in chapter 3, and that's next week. All right, let's pray.